This is February 19th, 2012. And for Taisho today, I'd like to talk about willpower, read a couple of articles and comment on them. I've been responding to the term intensive reports from out-of-town members, and so this is kind of at the front of my mind, how to make commitments and then stick to them through willpower and self-discipline. Ideally, I suppose this is a topic that I could have addressed right before New Year's, because you'll hear in these articles the importance of making a resolution, or right before the term intensive that we're in the middle of right now. For those of you who may not know, what we call a term intensive is a period of several weeks. We have it twice a year. In the fall, I think it's 3 weeks, and in the winter, it's 5 weeks. A period in which participants make pledges or commitments to increase their sitting, or zazen, or in other ways to intensify their practice, or simplify their lives in some way, that then they strive to uphold these commitments, and meet once a week to talk about them. For those who participate long distance, then the only recourse is to send in these reports where they will say how they succeeded or failed in their commitments, and that's what I've been responding to lately. I'm going to start by reading from an article in the New York Times Sunday Review for January 8th of this year. Parts of it, anyway. And the title is "Be It Resolved." And then the subtitle, "To Keep Your New Year's Promises to Yourself." No, "To Keep Your New Year's Promises to Yourself. First, recognize that human will is a depletable physical resource. But where there's willpower reinforced, there's a way." And this is by a John Tierney, who's the findings columnist for Science Times. And this Tierney is the co-author of a book we read from in a Taisho last September called Willpower, Rediscovering the Greatest Human Strength. Now, in that article, in that book, I think I read from an article about the book, a review of the book, this author, Tierney, and his co-author, Baumeister, they surveyed a large body of scientific research to conclude that willpower is limited and depends on a continuous supply of the simple sugar, glucose. When glucose is depleted, you fall prey to impulse shopping, affairs, and cookies. The solution? Try to get some glucose in you, Mr. Tierney told NPR. And now this this article in the last month. So he starts off, "It's still early in 2012, so let's be optimistic. Let's assume you have made a New Year's resolution and have not yet broken it." This is dated January 8th. Based on studies of past resolutions, here are some uplifting predictions. One, whatever you hope for this year, to lose weight, to exercise more, to spend less money, you're much more likely to make improvements than someone who hasn't made a formal resolution. Two, if you can make it through the rest of January, you have a good chance of lasting a lot longer. And three, with a few relatively painless strategies and new digital tools, you can significantly boost your odds of success. And then he goes on, for a not-so-uplifting prediction, most people are not going to keep their resolutions all year long. They'll start out with the best of intentions, but the worst of strategies, expecting that they'll somehow find the willpower to resist temptation after temptation. By the end of January, a third will have broken their resolutions, and by July, more than half will have lapsed. They'll fail because they'll eventually run out of willpower, which social scientists no longer regard as simply a metaphor. They've recently reported that willpower is a real form of mental energy powered by glucose in the bloodstream, which is used up as you exert self-control. The result is ego depletion, as this state of mental fatigue was named by Roy Baumeister, a social psychologist at Florida State University and my co-author of a book on willpower. That's the book we just mentioned. He and many of his colleagues have concluded that the way to keep a New Year's resolution is to anticipate the limits of your willpower. Ego, the word ego is such an ambiguous word. I've tried to use it less than we used to in the earlier days of the center. In Zen terms, we generally use the word to mean the notion of a separate self. But in broader society, ego is used more in the sense of a strength of mind, and I think it's a valid way to understand it. It's another way of understanding the word ego, strength. In fact, there's a Joseph Goldstein, very prominent Buddhist teacher, one of the original best-known Buddhist teachers in the Vipassana Buddhist tradition. He suggests that we can understand ego that way, strength of mind, which comes very close to willpower. The problem with the word ego, as it has been used sometimes in Zen, is it invites us to substantiate it, the self. Ego so easily and so often is used as a kind of a Buddhist term for Satan. You know, ego, you've got ego, I've got ego, oh, my ego, this. Whereas there's nothing there. There's no little evil man or woman in us that's pulling the strings. And this is the fundamental insight that we come to through awakening, is that there is no self, there is no ego, ultimately. So it's dangerous to talk about ego too much, and because then it just becomes fixed in the mind as another concept we have to get rid of eventually. Here he is using it more in terms of our ability to exert our willpower or make choices. Anyway, about these who study willpower and ego depletion, one of their newest studies published last month in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology tracked people's reactions to temptations throughout the day. The study showed that the people with the best self-control, paradoxically, are the ones who use their willpower less often. Instead of fending off one urge after another, these people set up their lives to minimize temptations. They play offense, not defense, using their willpower in advance so that they avoid crises, conserve their energy, and outsource as much self-control as they can. This is, I think, a really good way of putting it. Using one's willpower in advance. So, in my own experience, I learned long ago that if I go to an all-you-can-eat buffet, I'm dead in the water because I want to get my money's worth, and I love to eat, by the way. but if you can not let yourself go to an all-you-can-eat buffet, then there the problem is resolved. And many people who am I talking to? Many of you know this just intuitively or through your experience, that if you can resist the temptation to put yourself in situations where you're more likely to be overcome by the temptation, then you're more likely to be able to not fall prey to it. Ulysses strapping himself to the mast of the ship so they wouldn't have the option of responding to the call of the sirens. This is why one reason Sashin works so well is because you put yourself into that highly structured environment where most of your options are taken away from you, then you can do great things. You can really find great sources of willpower. Same with anyone in any kind of 12-step program knows that it's so important. The situations we put ourselves in and the people with whom we associate. So I think that's what he means, using willpower in advance. Willpower doesn't just have to mean in a negative sense. It also means won't power. I won't meet my friends at the local bar. I won't go to this party where I know that pot's going to be smoked. They play offense, not defense, using their willpower in advance so they avoid crises, conserve their energy, and outsource as much self-control as they can. These strategies are particularly important if you're trying to lose weight, which is the most typical New Year's resolution, as well as the most difficult. The more you starve your body, the less glucose there will be in your bloodstream, and that means less willpower. Because of this vicious cycle, even people with great self-control in the rest of their lives can have a terrible time remaining slim. Self-restraint can seem harder than ever because there are so many new temptations being marketed. High-calorie foods, distracting gadgets, time-sucking websites. But there are also better strategies than ever available thanks to new research in both the lab and the real world, including vast troves of data from online programs for improving self-control. And then he says, before we get to the data, consider one well-financed pioneer, how one well-financed pioneer put these strategies into practice. And then he spends several paragraphs describing a hedge fund manager who had the wealth to hire a personal trainer or two to monitor him all the time. I'm going to skip over that. And then and it talks about the success the guy had. He went from 300 weighing 375 pounds to 190 pounds using all these things that his money could buy him. And then the author says, obviously, Doug Teitelbaum is not every man. Most of us can't afford to hire personal trainers to monitor us around the clock, but anyone with a smartphone or a computer has access to outside help, and anyone can still follow his basic strategies. And here is where we get more into the dynamics of the term intensive. So here are the strategies. First of all, set a single clear goal. Instead of resolving to, quote, lose weight or eat healthier, set a specific goal. Say, lose a pound a week. And limit yourself to one big resolution at a time. I do question people in the term intensive who have a whole potpourri of different resolutions, all kinds of different things they're going to do. I suspect that it can be too many things, even though each commitment is relatively modest. If you have too many, it gets your efforts become too refracted. But the specificity of the commitment is important. Over the years that we've had these term intensive, I've slightly revised my words of advice that we have on the website about the term intensive, and one of them is to be specific, and to make your commitment quantifiable, so you can be accountable for it. This is half of the point of the term intensive, is to make yourself accountable, at least to yourself, at the very least. So that means not saying I'm going to do more sitting every day or every week, but how much more? We actually changed the form, the application, the reservation form, registration form, to reflect that, and ask people to put in the little boxes that are available there what that means by more sitting. I personally think it's wise often to make those numbers, peg them to the week rather than the day, but I could see it either way, but you have more flexibility if you say I'm going to sit 3 extra hours a week. Then if something comes up, you're not derailed, and you can catch up later in the week. But probably there are people who find the opposite. They helps to do it every, have it pegged to the day. But the article goes on. If you're trying to quit smoking or save money, don't bother counting how many calories you consume or burn up. With a finite supply of willpower, it's tough enough to keep one resolution. As so-and-so, another psychologist, reported in 2002 after having tracked people for 6 months after New Year's. By the end of January, 36% of them had broken their resolutions. After that, the failures happened more slowly. Half were still keeping their resolutions in March, and by July, the success rate was still 44%. Less than half, admittedly, but still impressive compared to the control group of people who had the same goals but didn't make formal resolutions. Here we talk about this at New Year's, the importance of vocalizing in our ceremonies here, vocalizing our resolutions, and also to include the resolution part in a repentance. When we have the repentance ceremony, we begin by repenting for some something we said or did or some pattern that we want to get free of, and then to follow it up in our statement with the statement of resolution. Contrary to widespread public opinion, a considerable proportion of New Year resolvers do succeed. You are 10 times more likely to change by making a New Year's resolution compared to non-resolvers with the identical goals and comparable motivation to change. Here's the next advice he gives. Pre-commit. Odysseus's classic strategy, having himself tied to the mast, I should have said Odysseus rather than Ulysses, still works against modern sirens. Besides the simple things you do yourself, plan meals in advance, keep junk food out of the kitchen, schedule workouts with friends, go to the store without a credit card, you can further bind yourself by emailing your goals to friends or posting it on Facebook. And this is where those out-of-town reports seem to be helpful to people. If they have me or... we'll get to that just a bit later. Next advice, outsource. You can outsource self-control by sharing your progress with friends through Twitter posts about your weight or your workouts, or by making a formal contract at certain websites. And then he mentioned some specific websites. I don't want to get into that all that in my talk here. At one of these websites called StickK, you set the goal and have the option of naming a referee to enforce it. So that's the idea in the term intensive behind having these weekly meetings where people report in, or for out of town people having me as the referee so they can let me know how they did and can feel accountable. The more you pre-commit, the better you do, according to the research. The success rate for people who don't name a referee is only 29%, but it rises to 59% when there's a referee and so forth. I won't get into it. Keep track, he says. Nutritionists used to advise people not to weigh themselves more than once a week, supposedly so as not to get discouraged by fluctuations. But recent research has shown that daily weigh-ins work better. Self-monitoring is vital to any kind of resolution, and new tools will do the grunt work for you. And he gives some of these online tools. Entrepreneurs are rushing to monitor just about every aspect of your life, your health, your moods, your sleep, and you can find dozens of their products by consulting websites like, listen to this one, Quantified Self and Life Hacker. Next advice, don't overreact to a lapse. This is very important. One reason dieters fail is a phenomenon formally known as counter-regulatory eating and informally known as the what the hell effect. Once they lapse, they figure the day's diet is blown anyway, so they can go on to finish the whole carton of ice cream, thereby doing far more damage than the original lapse. I've often referred to this in advising people. I refer to it as the all or nothing trap. And this is because we all fail. We all fail at our resolutions all the time. This is absolutely essential to get clear about, to get beyond this notion that once we fail that somehow the spell is broken or we just what's the point in going on? This is crazy thought. Zen Master Dogen referred somewhere to Zen practice as he referred to Zazen as a practice of continuous failure. Consider that, continuous failure. We all know what this means. It means we sit down, cross our legs, and we set about to keep our mind on our practice, the koan or the breath, whatever. And the next thing we know, the mind has wandered off. And what do? We know what we learn what we do. We don't just throw up our hands and say, oh, this mind is, you know, beyond hope, you know. We go back. We go back, we pick ourselves up. This is what children, what toddlers know. When they fall down, they don't lie there and feel sorry for themselves. They get up. And this is like 85% of practice, just maybe more. Maybe it's 100, I don't know. Is each time we lose it, we just pick it up again. This is half of my teaching in Sesshin is that. Just when you lose it, don't compound the problem by thinking about how you've lost it, or thinking about how you failed, or thinking about how slow your progress is. Just go back to the practice. It's always there. In the breath, it's especially obvious. We can't ever be separated from our breath. We just have to redirect our attention back to the breath. Well, this is rudimentary, but it may be obvious to everyone what I'm saying, but because of the force of our habits, we don't act on it. We continually get pulled aside and caught in a narrative of failure. Don't overreact to a lapse. And the next, tomorrow is another taste. One of the cheeriest new findings from diet research comes from an experiment in which people had to resist a bowl of M&Ms. The ones who told themselves they could have the candy later had a much easier time than the ones who swore off M&Ms permanently. Again, the all-or-nothing idea. So when the dessert cart arrives, promise yourself that you'll sample each of the treats, but just not tonight. I now have started advising people at workshops, introductory workshops, to not try to give up whatever bad habits they want to be free of, not to try to give them up all at once, with the exception of alcohol or illegal drugs. These are best given up, especially if one has a real problem with it and one has gotten into trouble in the past. You have to give that up right away. But all the other things, often, not always maybe, but often, it's better to just try to pare away the time you spend in front of the computer, surfing the web for pornography, or smoking, or eating meat, or any number of other things that we want to get rid of. His next advice is reward often. If you use willpower only to deny yourself pleasures, it becomes a grim, thankless form of defense. But when you use it to gain something, you can wring pleasure out of the dreariest tasks. Young people who seem hopelessly undisciplined in school or on the job will concentrate for hour after hour on video games because there's a steady series of prizes. That's the feeling to aim for in the real world. if you quit smoking, earmark some of the savings for expensive meals. If your waistline shrinks, splurge on new clothes. One new exercise monitor, the Strive, will make donations to charity based on how many steps you take. Other gadgets and apps will award points or trophies. Even the tiniest and silliest rewards can make a difference. If you want your willpower to last all year, every little bit helps. I could imagine purists hearing this, Zen purists hearing this and thinking to themselves, well, we're supposed to get beyond the whole rewarding ourselves for our successes and so forth, but you got to be realistic about these things. You accept yourself where you are, and you do whatever helps you stay on this path. Zen is so practical. It is so pragmatic. Whatever works is all right, is good. Which means it's vital to get a realistic assessment of where you're at and what you're capable of. And that's also what I find myself over and over advising people in the term intensive is don't overreach in your commitments. Look squarely at what you're capable of. Don't think that you can remake yourself in one term intensive. It's better to be more modest in your pledge of how you want to increase your sitting or whatever. Be more modest and fulfill it rather than shooting for the moon and failing. Now, there is another article, and this is from last November, that challenges this idea that willpower gets depleted. And this is also in the New York Times, by a assistant professor of psychology at Stanford by the name of Greg Walton. It begins, is willpower an illusion? Is the traditional notion of a deep mental reservoir of strength a fiction? In recent years, the popular answer has been yes. Our abilities, according to this argument, are constrained by the narrow limits of our biology. In her book, Health at Every Size, the nutritionist Linda Bacon argues that because of how the brain's hypothalamus works, it is a myth that anyone can will himself to lose weight by maintaining a diet. It's not your fault, she writes. Biology is so powerful, it can make you break that diet. And then he goes on to quote this book we mentioned at the beginning of Taisho, Willpower, Rediscovering the Greatest Human Strength by this John Tierney and Roy Baumeister, concluding that willpower is limited and depends on a continuous supply of the simple sugar glucose. And then he says, such theories have an obvious appeal. Attributing failures of willpower to our fixed biological limits justifies our procrastination as well as our growing waistlines. Not only that, we also get to consume more sugar. But are these theories correct? And then he says, we don't think so. In research that we conducted with the psychologist Veronica Job, we confirmed that willpower can indeed be quite limited, but only if you believe it is. But only if you believe it is. When people believe that willpower is fixed and limited, their willpower is easily depleted. But when people believe that willpower is self-renewing, that when you work hard, you're energized to work more, that when you've resisted one temptation, you can better resist the next one, then people successfully exert more willpower. It turns out that willpower is in your head. I was very skeptical of that book, those findings, that willpower. It strikes me as such a materialistic perspective on something that is so subtle and mysterious, the willpower, that it's just a matter of glucose. We know through long practice that you can't tease apart the physical and the mental. We know this from the growing body of research about placebos. It's astounding how much difference the mind makes. But he goes on. He describes a study in which they gave one group of people an easy task and another group a more difficult task that involved self-control. I won't describe it. It gets too detailed. And then after they each did their tasks, everyone performed a tricky cognitive task in which they had to exert self-control to avoid making mistakes. When the initial task was easy, that's the group of people who had the easy task, and willpower wasn't required, people did well on the tricky cognitive task that followed. But when the initial task was hard and involved self-control, people who believed that willpower was limited made almost twice as many mistakes on the tricky cognitive task as did the group that performed the initial easy task. So, okay, so far, this finding replicates many studies by Baumeister and Tierney as evidence that willpower is limited and easily depleted. But, here's the but. But strikingly, we found that people who believed that willpower was not limited continued to perform well on the second task, making few mistakes even after facing the difficult initial task. You may contend that these results show only that some people just happen to have more willpower and know that they do. But on the contrary, we found that anyone can be prompted to think that willpower is not so limited. When we had people read statements that reminded them of the power of willpower, like, quote, sometimes working on a strenuous mental task can make you feel energized for further challenging activities, they kept on working and performing well with no sign of depletion. We also studied this phenomenon in the real world. They took college students, followed them over 5 weeks during stressful times like final exam week. Students who believed that willpower was not limited reported eating less junk food and procrastinating less than students who did not share that belief. They also showed more academic growth, earning better grades that term than their pessimistic counterparts. Furthermore, when we taught college students that willpower was not so limited, they showed similar increases in willpower, and so forth. How does this happen? People who think that willpower is limited are on the lookout for signs of fatigue. When they detect fatigue, they slack off. People who get the message that willpower is not so limited may feel tired, but for them, this is no sign to give up. It's a sign to dig deeper and find more resources. What about the glucose idea, which seems supported by so much science? Baumeister and Tierney describe studies showing that giving people glucose in the form of a sugar drink restores their willpower. But in our latest research, we found that when people believe in willpower, they don't need sugar. They perform well whether they consume sugar or not. Sugar helps people only when they think that willpower is sharply limited. It's not sugar we need. It's a change in mindset. Now, he emphasizes imparting the belief in the willpower is not limited. Or he says teaching people that willpower is not limited. But in practice, teaching only goes so far. What we really, our real ultimate resource in practice is our own experience. So he refers to belief systems, getting people to believe. And that's probably better than nothing, seems it is. But in Zen, we want to go beyond beliefs. Beliefs, ultimately, are things we acquire, acquiring the belief in something. But practice, really, ultimately, practice is not about acquiring anything. It's losing our wrong ideas. In this case, it would be for people who have read this earlier book, that our willpower is limited, we find through practice that we lose that notion of our limitation. We find that willpower is like a muscle that you can exercise and strengthen. Now, no one has to believe me when I say this. You don't have to believe me because it's not about beliefs, ultimately. It's about practice. Do the practice. Stick with it. Stick with it long enough and see if you don't find yourself that willpower is something that we can develop endlessly. It's all about experience. Roshi Kaplow used to make the point that in Zen, faith is experience. Faith is based on experience. When we've experienced the benefits of practice, that's how our faith grows. We don't have to believe it. Belief is something other than practice. We just have to do it, do the practice, see what it yields, see what the dividends we reap from the practice, and there's the growth of faith. Then he says, to be sure, willpower is not completely unlimited. Food and rest are, of course, necessary for functioning, and many struggles that people face are quite difficult. The question is how often we need extra sugar boosts. Messages suggesting that willpower is severely limited and that we need constant energy sugar boosts are bound to further inflate the American waistline and so forth. At stake in this debate is not just a question about the nature of willpower. It's also a question of what kind of people we want to be. Do we want to be a people who dismiss our weaknesses as unchangeable? When a student struggles in math, should we tell that student, "Don't worry, you're just not a math person"? Do we want him to give up in the name of biology, or do we want him to work harder in the spirit of what he wants to become? Well, in Zen too, we go one step further. It's not that we want to work with a notion of who we want to become, but find out, work and see who we become, but not be limited, not be bound by the notion of who we are. That's the great limitation. What enlightenment reveals is that ultimately there is no person here. That we are energy in flux. We can remake ourselves. We can reform ourselves. We can work with the areas in which we have found ourselves limited. We're working with energy. We're not trying to transform ourselves from one self to another self. We're just working with energy. And there's no reason we can, no way we can ever fail in any kind of final way. We trip up, and then we just keep working with it, and see for ourselves. No one needs to believe any of this, but practice. Do it every day, not sporadically, but do it every day. Don't try to overdo it. Do it so that you can do it realistically, do enough, not too much, but enough that you can do it every day, and see what happens. See if through your own experience you don't confirm much of what I've read and said today. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.